Hello, on this week's program, with the opening of a new gallery space and ahead of a royal visit, Eric Brannan takes us to the American Swedish Historical Museum in Philadelphia. We speak with the pianist Hélène Grimaud, and Susan Lewis profiles Hedgerow Theatre in suburban Philadelphia, which has been forging its own unique artistic path since 1923. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The Patterson Avenue section of South Philadelphia is best known as the home of the city's sports complex, a conurbation of great hulking sculptures reflecting a popular part of the city's identity and recent history. Yet in the shadow of these stadiums is an institution that explores a culture that helped shape the very existence of Philadelphia and the surrounding region. Built in 1926 and nestled in FDR Park in a neoclassical revival building, is the American Swedish Historical Museum. Now, as WRTI's Eric Brannan reports, the museum serves to remind visitors of the long history of the influence of the Swedish people on the Delaware Valley.
Traces of Philadelphia's Swedish heritage are easy to find. Take a close look at the city's seal or its flag. Their motif of blue and gold vertical stripes bears a strong resemblance to Sweden's national flag, which features a gold cross on a blue background. This is no coincidence, according to the Swedish Historical Museum's executive director, Tracy Beck.
That is all based on the fact that the Swedes were the first Western settlers in this area, and so their colors were sort of embraced by the state and the cities around here.
In 1638, decades before William Penn and his fellow Quakers arrived, a small group of Swedish settlers came to the region. Along the banks of the Delaware River, in modern-day Delaware, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, they formed the New Sweden Colony. Kim Erik Williams, historian at the Swedish Colonial Society and director of the Swedish Language Program at the University of Pennsylvania, says that settlements like New Sweden were potentially lucrative endeavors.
The idea was to come, establish a fort, and then trade with the Indians, get enough furs that you possibly could, take them back to Europe and make money. And the only settlements you had would be a couple farms around the fort which were necessary for food for the soldiers to keep the place going.
One of the museum's many exhibition spaces, the New Sweden Gallery, is dedicated to chronicling the first 60 years of the Swedish presence in America. Thanks to a gift from Esther Ann McFarland, a direct descendant of one of the original colonists, the space has recently undergone a major renovation. Executive Director Tracy Beck says that the new gallery gives a more focused look at where the Swedish settlements were and how, after a brief takeover by the Dutch, the British stake their claim.
We had someone create an animated map that shows from 1638, when the Swedes arrived in Delaware, until about 1700, where there are documented things like forts, blockhouses, churches, where we know the people were settling. So you can kind of watch the map as it changes from, and you get more Swedes, and then you see the British arrive with William Penn, and then you see the British take over. The Swedes are still there, but you can see how they were totally engulfed by the British by 1700.
Beck says that one of the reasons the British were so much more successful was mostly thanks to their greater resources.
The Swedes didn't have regular influxes coming from Sweden. So there were several ships that came, but sometimes it would be years between ships that brought provisions and more settlers.
The Swedes relied heavily on trade with the Native American population. This relationship is depicted in a mural covering the towering ceiling of the museum's grand lobby. Compared to other colonial powers like the Dutch and the English, the Scandinavian settlers peacefully coexisted with the Native Americans. According to the museum's curator, Carrie Hogan, their low profile was out of necessity.
The Swedes were very judicious. They were always outnumbered in so many respects. So they played it safe. They traded very carefully. They were nonviolent.
Though the colonial Swedes had all but assimilated into the British colony by 1700, today there are 24 historic Swedish sites still preserved in the region. They consist of 8 old Swedes churches, parks, a full-scale replica ship, and historic log cabins, another part of New Sweden's legacy. Kim Erik Williams says many of the first Swedish settlers came from heavily forested areas and helped introduce log cabin construction to America.
This particular method of building a house, which three Swedish settlers, three men, could build a log cabin in a day. And that log cabin was good for 60 years. They were expert woodsmen. And this was a perfect sort of place to live in a country like America, which was filled with forests.
In addition to examining the lives of Swedish settlers in America, the museum also illustrates what life was like in colonial-era Sweden, says Executive Director Tracy Beck.
This is the stuga, which is a representation of what a one-room house in Sweden might have looked like. And so we have the corner fireplace that is typical of a Swedish home.
The Swedish Historical Museum houses 12 permanent galleries, including the stuga. There's a room that envelops visitors with a map of 17th century Sweden painted on walls covered with bronze leaf, while another gallery is dedicated to the Nobel Prize, founded by Swedish inventor and entrepreneur Alfred Nobel. Each year, the museum also hosts a Midsommar celebration, a major summer solstice holiday in Sweden. It traditionally involves raising a maypole around which celebrants dance and sing traditional songs. Kim Erik Williams says the holiday is all about daylight, a rare commodity at times in northern Scandinavia.
In December, you're getting 2 or 3 hours of light, but by the official midsummer, you have 24 hours of light rather than almost 24 hours of darkness. And so this certainly does call for a celebration.
Williams says that in the U.S. today, there are estimated to be over 20 million people of Swedish ancestry. Though many may be unaware of their colonial heritage, historical churches, scholarly research, and institutions like the American Swedish Historical Museum are there as a reminder of the lasting legacy of the new Swedes.
WRTI's Eric Brannan. The American Swedish Historical Museum on Patterson Avenue in South Philadelphia opens its newly renovated Sven Gunnarsson and Jonas Nilsson New Sweden Gallery on Tuesday. Princess Madeleine of Sweden will attend a members-only event at the museum tomorrow.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The French-born pianist Alain Grimaud has had a stellar career as a soloist, recitalist, and recording artist for more than 20 years. The 40-something-year-old pianist is gifted not only with great musical ability, but also with some extraordinary mental powers. She experiences synesthesia, a condition in which the physical senses overlap, and in her case, this gives her an ability to both see and touch music. In practice, this makes it possible for her to rehearse without a piano and still fully experience the music. She says that from an early age, she had great powers of concentration, a great help when she first began studying music. Over the years, her single-mindedness has garnered her a reputation as someone who can get exactly what she wants. She plays only repertoire of her own choosing, she refuses to commit to long periods on the road, and carries all of this off with a certain grace and charm. In a wide-ranging conversation at the Kimmel Center with Alain Grimaud, we discussed her approach to music and to life. I read something recently, and I'm paraphrasing here, where you said something to the effect that music is the greatest means of expressing emotion. And if we feel sometimes that we're on the wrong path or going down the wrong road, well, maybe we haven't gone down that road far enough. What music were you talking about, and how now does that apply to the works to which you're returning, or the works that are very, very familiar to you?
I mean, it has happened to me, for example, that with a piece, and if I can try to remember, the last case in point was actually Bach Italian Concerto. And, you know, I was naturally more drawn towards the more dramatic, one could even say romantic, pieces by Bach, for example, the Sixth Partita. And so both as a challenge and as a sort of fatal attraction, I found myself wanting to explore the Italian Concerto and trying to take it out of, you know, the sort of square box that it seems to be in the Handel tradition. And, you know, and after maybe a few weeks, I thought, oh, you know,
I didn't get it.
This is probably not for me. But then, of course, I hate the idea of giving up. When I start something, I hate not finishing it. And so I just couldn't bring myself to abandoning it halfway, and so I stayed with it. And I had the marvelous surprise of realizing maybe 6 weeks later that, you know, something had happened. And I was able to both be faithful to the text and not try to distort it in some, you know, ridiculous way, but at the same time find a mode of expression, find some freedom within the framework of the piece. And I thought, you see, you know, if I had given up when I thought all hope was lost, it would have actually been really a great shame. So I think in general, but where it goes also, I think, is for an audience, for example.
That's what I was going to say, yeah.
Because I think that the tragedy with classical music is people think if they don't have a background in the matter, if they aren't educated, that it's not for them. And of course, there's nothing less true than that. All you have to do is to have the ability to feel, which of course everyone does. And so if you allow yourself to feel, what the only thing you have to be aware of with classical music is that it is truly needing to be interactive. You can't just sit there and hope that the stimulation that the music provides is sufficient to draw you in. I mean, the more you put from yourself into it, the more you get back. So in that sense, you know, I think I was also, that's probably partly what I had in mind when I said that.
Yeah, but then people say, oh, she's Alain Grimaud. She's this amazing, prodigious musician, understood piano from an early age, has always got it, rehearses in her head. It's easy for her.
No, but no, it really isn't. You see, it's not easy for me, and it's not any easier than it would be for anyone else. Because again, it's only a matter of putting 100% of who you are into what you do in the moment. That means really giving it proper attention, because one of the problems these days is we're so constantly over-solicited, over-stimulated with a bunch of things that you tend to do things in automatic pilot mode, and then you don't actually connect with the essence of what you're, you know, dealing with, and that's, of course, the worst. So if you can be in this sort of zen-like conception of the moment.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Where there's nothing before, there's nothing after. This is all you've got now, and you make the most of it now. Then, you know, it's the diversity, the range of emotions that classical music can provide is really unequaled. And this is not coming from someone who is intolerant and doesn't like any other types of music. So, I mean, I listen to all kinds of things.
A certain peace does come with that ability to commit to the moment and just live in the moment and not think about what's happening in other aspects of your life or what's going to happen in 10 minutes. That's something you had from a very, very early age, that you could almost be obsessional about things from a very early age. Was that a good thing? Do you think that made your life easier, or did it make it more peaceful at an early age to be able to be so focused on one thing at a time?
Well, it made my life better when I was dealing with the appropriate substance to be letting this trait of temperament exercise itself. Before that, it wasn't so good because I was extremely focused, but if I didn't have anything to focus on, then it would sort of turn against, you know, me or things in my environment. So, but I think to be a musician, you have to be obsessive. That's what being a perfectionist is. You're never satisfied. You always have to go back at something, redo it, revisit it, dismantle it, put it back together. So I think it's, and I don't want to say a quality because it's not necessarily a quality, but it's just an idiosyncrasy, a characteristic of temperament that is in every musician.
I was speaking to a friend of mine about you who's interviewed you in the past, and he said Alain Grimaud has a great ability to get exactly what she wants without offending anybody, that you choose your own repertoire, you choose not to travel long distances or for long periods of time when you're performing. You've kind of established how you want to run your life, and if, I don't know, the record company or the presenters don't understand that, well, that's fine. Is that the case?
That is true. I mean, you do make a few enemies along the way. It's inevitable. And in fact, it's almost a good sign. You'd have to be quite suspicious of yourself and of the life you're leading if you didn't make a few enemies here and there. Because that's just what goes with the territory of just being yourself. So if you don't like to compromise too much, then, of course, you know, you're going to run into certain difficulties. But when I try to express what it is I need to do, I try to make clear that it's not against someone else. It just has to be my way. Now, it doesn't mean I'm completely not receptive to things from the outside. I mean, very often, you know, some of the best things I've done in my life have been suggested by others. But when they're suggested, I can immediately feel a resonance. And then I know that it's connecting with something inside of me. So be it that person is perceptive enough to think, you know, you might want to think about this. And all of a sudden, when I do, I see the reason why, you know, then all of a sudden there's this logic about, oh yes, you know, and all of a sudden I'm intrigued, and then I go down that path and there we are. So, you know, I don't want to say that anything that comes from the outside I immediately, you know, block out, not at all. But so if I feel I have to do something, I try to explain that, you know, there is no guarantee of quality. But if there is only one, is that you have to at least do things in a way that are essential and vital for you. Because if artistically, if you do something, but you could just as well do something else, there's something missing.
Sure.
You know, again, you have to do things because you can't live any other way.
Sure.
Yeah. Otherwise, otherwise it becomes anecdotal and becomes unessential. So.
You talk a lot. I mean, you mentioned resonances there, and I've read a lot about where you say things have to resonate with you, things have to feel right. You seem to have a really good instinct for what's going to be right for you, both personally and artistically, and you seem to have been able to trust that all of your adult life, certainly.
Yeah, I'm very lucky because it's true that I've always been able to follow my intuition. I think, you know, I owe this to my parents. And sometimes I think it's as simple as the environment in which you grow up. For example, I think a lot of people grow up with parents that is a bit of a, you know, dangerous road to go down. But still, a couple wants to give the appearance of love, but the children feel otherwise, they can feel that the love isn't there, or they can feel that people live a lie, but they're being told differently. This is something that very much negatively affects a child's trust in its own instinct.
Sure.
And so, and unfortunately, some people have to live with that baggage for a long, long time. So I think I was just very, very lucky that I grew up with great parents that called it as it was and didn't make any pretenses, you know, when there were difficulties. And at the same time, certainly the love was there. And so there was nothing ever false. And so it gave me a great, you know, head start of being able to realize as a child that what I felt inside was also how it really was. And I think later on, if you have that strength, later on you can then trust your inner voice versus what you see, when what you see you realize is not what people want you to believe it is.
That said, you are a thinker. You think very deeply, for starters, about music. I mean, is it true that you can practice a lot of the time in your own head without putting your hands on a piano?
Yes, absolutely, but I'm far from the only one. You know, I mean, if you read the Walter Gieseking had this, one of his books in which he discusses that, and I think most of my colleagues end up doing it, because you can't be a slave to an instrument all the time, because if you are, you're miserable, because there are always days, especially on the road touring, where you don't have access to a piano, and then what? And then you feel lost, because you haven't been able to reassure yourself as to the status of your relationship to the instrument. I mean, that's really unhealthy. Aside from the fact that it's an unhealthy period, because if you do all of your work at the instrument, there is the risk that you go again into automatic piloting.
You just rely on muscle memory.
Yeah, and then things stop making sense. And, you know, all three should always be connected. You know, the mind, the heart, and the body. But for that, you need great awareness. And you probably can't maintain that state of awareness 6, 7, 8 hours a day, which is what we normally practice at an instrument. So I think it's good to try to stay fresh at the instrument so that you can have that, you know, connection between all levels, and for there to be harmony in the gesture, in the overall gesture. And when you can't maintain that at the instrument, you should be working mentally, because if you have a clear mental image of what you want to accomplish, all you need to do is, if you don't know the piece by heart yet, you read it on your score, and you can hear it as you read it. If you know it by heart, you play it in your head without looking at the score, and you can make decisions about conceptual changes, about pulsation, architecture, you know, you name it, anything, really.
And what happens then when what's in your head doesn't transfer directly to the fingers, or does it ever happen that you put your hands on the keyboard and it's not how you heard it in your head?
Well, no, it's not really an issue. I mean, of course, you have to get to the keyboard and check, you know, physical coordinates every now and again, of course. And there are times when I practice at the piano a lot, but never when I know that I've gone beyond the point of being able to be fully there doing it. So I think you need both, and, you know, it's a matter of balance. But I think if you don't hear it first, then it's never really going to be there. Or if you rely on the instrumental practice to get there, to decide how you want to hear it, it can be very damaging physically, because then you get into those repetitive motion problems, because you are at the piano an inordinate amount of time, which is just beyond the limits of what the human body was conceived for.
Pianist Elaine Grimaud. Her latest CD on Deutsche Grammophon, called Resonances, features works for solo piano by Bartok, Berg, Liszt, and Mozart. Hedgerow Theatre and Media was founded in 1923 as a residential repertory theatre, where an ensemble company of artists and residents prepare several productions at once, rotating performances of these works. In its first several decades, Hedgerow was a hotbed for theatrical activity, and hedgerow actors, playwrights and directors went on to found other theatres in the region, including Malvern's People's Light and Theatre Company and the Freedom Theatre in North Philadelphia. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at the history and contemporary mission of this distinctive player in the history of American theatre.
Hedgerow, nestled next to a narrow, winding road in the woods, is housed in a former grist mill dating from 1840. Audience members pulling their cars into its small gravel parking lot may be greeted by one of Hedgerow's principal players.
My name is Zoran Kovčić, and I'm the operations manager at Hedgerow, which is a fancy title meaning whatever nobody else is doing, that's what I'm doing.
Kovčić steps into a range of roles, on stage and off.
I deal with our subcontractors, people come in to do our air conditioning repair or roof repair, things of that sort. I'm also an actor here in the company. I've been in over 150 shows. I design the sets and I build the sets with help and generally do whatever is necessary to help run a theater.
Kovčić, who has played Scrooge in A Christmas Carol and is a regular lead in the theater's summer farces, is the personification of Hedgerow's contemporary vision.
We don't create or build actors, we build theater people. So when someone new joins us, we find out what other talents and skills they have. But just because you happen to be in box office doesn't mean you're not going to be painting the set, or outside gardening, or helping to clean the bathrooms before the show.
In an age of specialization, this philosophy is an outgrowth of a long and colorful history of bucking commercial trends, a history that began before the theater in 1901 when architect William Price bought about 80 acres of land around the old 19th century mills and proceeded to renovate old housing and build new.
He was trying to build the ideal English village where craftsmen worked and lived in the same community. After Will Price, you had Jasper Dieter, 1923.
Hedgerow's current producing artistic director, Penelope Reed, says Jasper Dieter brought the same kind of idealism to his theatrical venture, which he founded as a residential repertory company.
And so that's what Jasper brings to Little Rose Valley, a company of artists who are focused on raising artistic expression instead of selling a show. So the focus in New York was on commercialism, selling the show, and here it was entirely at the time, how do we work together to make plays respond to the soul of the audiences?
The place drew other artists, like pioneering sculptor and furniture maker Wharton Escherick and his family. Escherick became friends with Dieter and built sets for plays and furniture for the theater's home, including a staircase and a large table that still grace the premises.
We have the hammer-handled chairs, axe-handled chairs that he made, and he gave them as payment for acting classes for his daughter.
Hedgerow did new plays, it did the classics, and it did plays which would become classics, like Eugene O'Neill's Emperor Jones and George Bernard Shaw's Candida. It was not a money-making venture, but some of Jasper Dieter's risks helped keep it afloat, like its company of African-American actors.
1929, they nearly went into complete bankruptcy. His African-American company took a play that had started here to New York, made money, and gave it back to Hedgerow.
Hedgerow continued operating through the 30s, 40s, and into the 50s, when it branched out, taking shows into Philadelphia. By 1955, says Reed, the business was on the brink of collapse.
It was probably overstretching. It had gotten out of the repertory model. There were enormous costs, and they didn't believe in fundraising.
Over the next decades, Hedgerow weathered ups and downs. In the late 50s and early 60s, it focused on education and its theater school. In the mid-60s, a small group of actors began to stage plays again. In 1968, Hedgerow revived the residency experience. Then in 1972, founder Jasper Dieter died, and artistic differences split the company and board into two camps.
Half the board left, half the board went and started People's Light and Theater.
Despite the schism, Hedgerow continued with classes, performances, and a residency program, still propelled by the spirit instilled by its founder. Like a patriarch, Jasper Dieter had created a theater family whose members would continue to pass down the lessons he taught.
My name is Lewis, Lou Lipa. many, many years ago. I can't even remember the year, but I came as an apprentice with the original Hedgerow Theater, meaning with the founder of the theater, Jasper Dieter, and I learned a lot from him. I learned how to look at a play, especially from a playwright's point of view, although Jasper was not a playwright, but he had this great insight on how to get to the heart of the matter.
Lippa, now playwright in residence at People's Light and Theater, went to New York, where he had three plays produced off-Broadway, and in 1957 won an Obie for Best New Play for A House Remembered.
But I began to feel as though there was no ensemble. But I had learned about ensemble or company from the Hedgerow Theater, original Hedgerow Theater, when I was an apprentice here. So I missed it, and I came back to Philadelphia and so on.
Even in its tumultuous later years, Hedgerow drew young actors, like Susan Wayfall, who's been there since 1978. It was Hedgerow's Rose Schulman, visiting Boston University to teach acting, who made the connection with her.
I heard all about Hedgerow, and I wanted to be there and just sit across the table from Rose and watch her eat, because I just felt like this is where I needed to be. So when I got here 5 years after college, I stayed.
Jasper Dieter's theatrical progeny have kept the place going, even through crises, as when, in 1985, a fire burned the theater down to its stone walls.
It was very devastating, and we were out of our theater for 5 years.
At first, the company continued operations on the road, performing for church groups and using space at other performance venues, like Bristol Riverside Theater, Newman College, and Widener College. After another fire struck Widener's Black Box in the middle of a Hedgerow season, they decided to do shows in the only facility they had, the house up the road from the mill, where Wayfall and others lived.
You could only see about 25, 30 people. They entered from the porch. We had all these actors entering from the kitchen. We had cookies and juice out on the porch. And we did that for another year and a half to try to keep going. I remember being in front of the Acme Frozen Foods with a spring water jug. Please help rebuild our theater.
Funds raised from the community, foundations, and government, combined with insurance proceeds, went to rebuilding Hedgerow's home. By 1990, the shell of the former grist mill had been restored, and Hedgerow moved back in. That year, Penelope Reed was brought in as artistic director to rebuild the company. She brought back the repertory model and worked to strengthen relationships with those in the local acting community.
We do equity shows. We also do intergenerational shows, and we have our school. I suppose what I bring to it is that I really believe in the interaction between the audience and the actors. So that interplay is very important to me. It is not about the trappings of theater, all of the pyrotechnics.
Hedgerow continues to renovate, making the historic structure more user-friendly for the disabled, moving seats to allow for better sight lines, developing gardens, and opening up a new entrance on the side. The new improvements will commingle with artifacts from the past, like the charred beams which remain overhead in the front lobby, and Wharton Esherick's 1935 table, which sits in the reception area along with photos of old productions. Reminders of what came before, the challenges, the triumphs, and the people who have kept the Hedgerow vision alive for nearly a century.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Two Into One by Ray Cooney is at the Hedgerow Theatre until August 7th. Penelope Reed plays Emily Dickinson in The Belle of Amherst, which opens today and runs Saturday afternoons through June 25th. And that's our program for this week. You can hear an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony in C under music director Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan, our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.